Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The day today is April 18th, 2023, and this is episode 374. You are listening to Radio Warnerd at patreon.com/Radio Warnerd, where you subscribe. I'm the ghost, Mark Ames. Made it across the border, as I said. So back in lovely Rochester, New York. And I'm on the line with John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, a.k.a. the Warnerd in the heel of the boot of Italy. John, how you doing?
Yeah, that's about as exactly as you can describe it. I'm sort of in a weird hotel 10 miles south of Bari.
South of Bari.
That, middle of nowhere, one of those freeway landscapes where you can't go anywhere on foot. It's like trying to walk out of an airport. I don't know if anybody's ever tried to do that, but I've done that a few times when I didn't have any money. And you cannot walk out of an airport.
No.
I tried to walk out of Miami Airport when I was going to an academic conference in like 1990. And I was covered in sweat, and I viewed a lot of swampland, but I never got out of the airport. And this is like that.
Oh, that's too bad. Are you guys going to be there for long? Are you going to get to somewhere better?
I mean, we'll get to Lecce, further down the boot heel.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, we have a great guest on our show today, Philip Short. I think we've talked probably more than a few times in the past about his incredible biography on Mao that we always recommend. In fact, I remember. I know I've given copies to people over the years, and I remember, I want to say in 2000, I think the book came out in 1999, Short's Mao biography. And in 2000, I believe it was, or 2001, I gave a copy to Lamonov. And then I left. I went to Kentucky for a year, and I know he loved the book. He was fascinated by it. And then 6 months later, he gets arrested for organizing what looks kind of like a long march thing, allegedly organizing an invasion from Altai into Kazakhstan. And I always kind of wondered, I wonder if that book had any influence. I know he was really rarely responded to books like that. I gave him a few books over the years, but that book he was really impressed by. Mao is, to quote Dennis Hopper, the man, he reads poetry. It's like, anyway.
No, he wrote poetry. He wrote some damn good poetry.
And a damn good poet and great sayings. I mean, there's so many great sayings in that book. Yeah. Anyway, so Philip Short, I tried to get on the show some years ago, and he said, I'm too deep in another book. I can't talk about it now. And it turned out he was writing a biography on Putin. So that's what we're going to be discussing with Philip Short today, his new biography on Putin, which is getting hate reviewed by so-called Putin experts because he doesn't sort of go with the grain in the whole Putin expertise that is popular these days. Anyway, before we do that, big news in war news that happened just between the last episode and this one is the outbreak of what looks like the beginnings of potential civil war, quite serious outbreak of violence in Sudan between the two leaders of the military dictatorship, so-called interim military dictatorship.
Yeah, Sudan finally exploded, and it was due for an explosion. It was pretty clear for a long time. I guess the first thing to mention is Sudan doesn't mean what it used to mean. It used to be the third biggest country in Africa. But that was before South Sudan, which is the non-Muslim, mostly so-called black part of Sudan, withdrew in 2011 in one of the more remarkable referendum results ever recorded. The vote was in favor of withdrawal by 98.6% or something. And oddly enough, there was no suspicion that it was faked. That was the real result. So South Sudan went its own way, which has not been a very happy way, but that's another story. So what's left of Sudan now is mainly a string of cities along the Nile. And it can be referred to as a riparian elite that runs the country. That is a riverside elite running the country. In fact, Joshua Kreis, who wrote an excellent article recently for New Left Review. Described it as such, the riparian elite. So there are a series of cities like Khartoum on the right bank, Omdurman on the left bank, and then further north, Meroe. The population now, thanks to the dissolution, breakup with South Sudan, is 70% Arab. And the most important thing that happened to this part of Sudan after the horrific wars in South Sudan was the Darfur breakup. And what happened there in the southwest corner of the country was that the local peoples of Darfur, the Four, Darfur meaning country of the Four, and Zagawa and Bagara, the Arabs of the region, got involved in a terrible struggle that was used and funded by Omar al-Bashir, the strongman of Sudan, who was deposed only in 2019. That's when things started to happen in Sudan. He was deposed because even the Khartoum elite, the riparian elite, decided he was bad for business, and because the youth, and it's a very young country, were getting rambunctious, and the army, which was perfectly willing to shoot people in distant corners of the country, didn't want to shoot Khartoum kids because they might be relatives. So they finally got rid of Bashir. Then they got rid of the transitional civilian regime a couple of years later. And they decided, okay, there's the rapid support force, which is the militias we've developed to deal with stuff like Darfur. That is the death squads that we made, the Janjaweed. And there's the Sudan armed forces, the traditional armed forces. And we are going to rule together and keep the civilians hanging around waiting for when we say we're going to give them the country back. Well, we're probably not going to give it back. So the leaders of these two factions are General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, also known as Hemedti, Little Mohamed, head of the RSF, and a very feared genocidaire from Darfur, head of the Janjaweed, meaning the evil riders, and General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, the head of the official Sudan military. And these guys got along about as well as you'd expect them to. I mean, Burhan, the leader of the old staid armed forces, thought the way the old staid river elite did. You know, he was Islamist to the core, but he was also full of, frankly, racial scorn for people from the peripheries, because like much of the Khartoum elite, he considers himself a different color and a different quality than most of Sudanese people. And the RSF commander, Hemedti, came up the harder way. You know, he came up out of Kansas, as the saying goes, and Darfur was a pretty rough Kansas. Yeah. Made a lot of money in the meantime, and now he wants what's his, as he sees it. And they're going to fight over the country, basically. And there's not much that can stop them. A lot of calls for peace, which don't seem to matter. So at the moment, starting in April 15th, tax day, the bill for Sudan came due, and they started fighting in the streets in Khartoum and other cities along the river. The fighting has been kind of interesting. It's been mainly the infantry of the RSF, the Janjaweed, and the air force and artillery of the Sudan army the RSF doesn't have any air force, and they don't have the same level of artillery as the Army. The Army has all the hardware, but they probably do have the better infantry. So it's kind of a standoff now, and it's not clear who owns what. Basically, the RSF has control of most of Darfur in the southwest. The Army claims control of the cities along the river, but the RSF has moved its troops into airports in many of the cities, including Khartoum, and they will at least have to be shelled out of there, and they will do incredible damage because urban combat, which is probably the big mode of warfare for this century so far, shows that the way to defeat a determined enemy, the only way, is to blow up the whole place and kill them in the rubble. And it's very ugly and it's very slow. And it's the only way to avoid massive casualties for your forces.
Yeah, it seems as if this is not settled really quickly, and that clock has already probably passed, or that moment has passed. Like, it's going to be a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. And probably, like most of these conflicts, there won't be an official start moment, and there won't be a stopwatch running and then time called. It will go on. It will stop for a while. There's supposed to be a ceasefire at the moment. I don't know if it's holding or not. I would guess it's not. But even if it does, it will eventually be violated and the guns will come out again, and then they'll go quiet for a while as people try to negotiate. And basically everyone has to cower without energy in their houses, without air conditioning for that matter, while the big guys duke it out and try to settle their differences. It's bad for everybody.
Mm-hmm. There are some outside forces. It's really debatable how much they're influencing any of this.
Yeah.
At least in the American press, the only sort of outside actor or way to, I think, to get people's interest is to say, oh, the Wagner Group, the infamous Russian Blackwater, you know, private mercenary group, is involved in Sudan. They've been involved in gold mining concessions, and it's really not clear exactly what else. Now, if they're involved in gold mining, that would suggest that they're doing business with the RSF, the former Janjaweed genocidaires. But on the other hand, Russia, the state, has been trying to arrange and has been working on arranging some kind of port naval rights with the Sudanese government. So I'm not really sure what role they're playing. And then, of course, Egypt is in very deep with the army.
Yeah, Egypt's in with Burhan's people and the army. Yeah. And the United Arab Emirates, which have been playing an interesting game lately, much smarter than they used to be. They're very much aligned with the RSF and with Hemeti. They also bought a ton of farmland in Sudan because their own territory is basically sand. It's sand with oil under it, but it's still dry sand. And they've invested heavily in Sudan land and agriculture. And they seem to be backing Hemedti.
Yes.
Yeah, it's not clear whether that will sway things.
Yeah, I get the sense this is like 98% local, if not 100%. But yeah, and they also had the UAE and the Saudis used a lot of RSF, ex-Janjaweed people in Yemen as mercenaries for Yemen.
Yep. And that means, you've got thousands of itchy trigger fingers back home and looking for work, which means looking for somewhere to shoot their guns.
Yeah.
And they've got that now.
Yeah. So we're going to keep our eye on that. But anyway, right now, I think let's get to our interview with Philip Short. Okay, we are really excited, about this. To introduce to you today our guest, Philip Short, somebody that whose books we've recommended, both John and I, think, to a lot of people, including listeners, and his books we've admired a lot. And so we're really happy to have him on today. Philip is the author of several biographies. Perhaps his best known up to now was Mao, A Life, which is really the standard for biographies, if you ask me. For it's really fantastic.
Yeah, Pol Pot, it's a wonderful book.
It really is. I mean, they all are. That one is just blew me away. Pol Pot, History of a Nightmare, which is a pretty nightmarish book. Mm-hmm. Mitterrand, A Study in Ambiguity. And his newest book, which is just released last fall, Putin. It's in America, at least, it is, the title is just Putin. It was put out by Henry Holt. Philip spent a long career as a foreign correspondent for the BBC in Moscow, Washington, and other world capitals. And he spent 8 years researching and writing this book, Putin. In fact, about, I think, 4 years ago now, I wrote to him because I'd just come across his Mitterrand biography and thought, you know, what a strange out of character, I mean, compared to some of the other characters he's written about, biography. And I'd love to get you on. And anyway, Philip was deep in and said, I'm really can't talk right now. Can't be bothered with anything else. Now I know why. It's a huge and fantastic book on Putin. So anyway, first of all, thank you for coming on and welcome to the show, Philip.
Glad to be with you.
Yeah. So 8 years.
It's why you don't do too many biographies, because they do take right. a huge amount of time to research. It's great fun. I mean, even Pol Pot, you may not think great fun is an appropriate phrase to use about Pol Pot, but it's fascinating to try and dig into a personality, especially in a complex personality who reflects the country and the culture in which he's grown up. And that, of course, is true of Putin as well. Putin is, whatever else one says about him, he is authentically Russian.
Right.
Well, that's one thing that Mark and I were both struck by when we read your Putin bio, that we share a real fondness for Eduard Limonov and the accounts of Putin's adolescence sounded so much like Limonov's book, Podrostok Savyanko, translated as Memoir of a Russian Punk. What he really describes beautifully is the fact that being a hooligan was the norm in post-war slums like the one he grew up in near Kharkov. And the question was, you don't want to be a 30-year-old criminal. You want to be a 15-year-old hooligan. That's cool. But you don't want to be a 30-year-old criminal who's been to Kolyma and has hepatitis and God knows what else. And so Eddie Baby, the character Adichka in Limonov, makes that choice. Like, no, I'm not going to go on to the, you know, Eagle Scout stage of criminality. And yeah. Putin seemed to do the same thing.
Absolutely. He made it a little earlier than 15. Getting into fourth, fifth grade at primary school was more or less the time he decided that he didn't want to end up like the other young ruffians in the courtyard of his apartment block. He did indeed grow up, as many, many kids did in that area. It was a pretty tough area of Leningrad. And he did grow up as a young tearaway. I think he exaggerated when he talked about it later, the extent to which he really was kind of on the borderline of crime. But certainly a lot of the people around him would go on to have criminal lives. And he was at ease with that. And it has to be said, he's remained at ease with that ever since. It hasn't been a problem for him. But right. for himself, he wanted something better. And he was lucky for two things. He had a teacher who really invested in him, took an interest in him at primary school. And he got into sport. He got into sambo, first of all, the kind of Russian martial arts based on judo, but with much more kind of physical wrestling in it than judo itself. And did rather well, became a youth champion, and again decided through his school that he wanted to do something more than that. He wanted to go into the KGB, which he managed to do.
Yeah, Lomonov wanted to be a poet, and that was his sort of way of thinking. I mean, that was his out from that world, and Putin wanted to go in the KGB, and that was his out.
It says a lot, doesn't it, actually?
Yeah. Yeah.
One wants to be a poet, the other wants to be a KGB officer. Well, something's up.
And they, and one of them wound up becoming the leader of the opposition.
I was surprised at what people said about his Sambo career. I frankly assumed that all that talk about Putin the judoka was just PR. But some of his coaches said, oh, he could have been a national champion. And I don't know, maybe that was also the kind of flattery that you give to former students who got really famous. But it sounded like he was pretty good.
He was a tournament champion, wasn't he?
He went on to be the junior national champion in 1976, which was just after he joined the KGB. So he could have had a career. I think he was gifted at it. There were certain qualities in his character which fitted judo, not showing emotions, disciplining oneself, being very, very self-controlled. And that's been a characteristic of Putin's all the way through, not someone who shows anger. I mean, his coach said one of the remarkable things about him was that after a match, whether he won or lost, he didn't show anything in his face or in his behavior. The moment the match ended, he was a different person again, as though he'd never been fighting. So, you know, there were things in that personality which fitted pretty well a judoka.
Mm-hmm. So I have to ask, first of all, I'm going to pull the camera back a little bit here. When were you a correspondent in the Soviet Union / Russia?
My goodness, you're going to make me confess my age.
No, we're all dinosaurs here. It's okay.
Yeah. Well, I'm more of a dinosaur than either of you are, I think. I was in Moscow.
Give you a run
I was in
for
Moscow
your money.
From 1974 to 1976 for the BBC, for those 3 years.
Okay, so in that period, did you, when you were a correspondent there, it was hard to back then. Well, it's hard to for a lot of correspondents even today, but did you get that sense of the Russia that you describe in this biography, you know, the world that created Putin, which is very much not sort of central Moscow, central Leningrad, but a much more typical life. Were you able to get any sense of that you were able to draw on when you did this biography, or was it just way too politically focused at the time?
No, I'm very, very grateful that I was in Russia in the 1970s, in the Soviet Union in the 1970s, because it means, I experienced what Soviet reality was like.
Right.
And that Soviet reality was what Putin and all his generation grew up in. And also, going back in 1990, as things were beginning to change, and then going back very recently, you really understand to what extent Russia has become another planet. How
yes.
totally, totally different it is today from what it was in the 1970s. And I know people say, and it's absolutely true, that Putin has immensely eroded freedoms, and he's pushing Russia back towards it was what it was in Soviet times. That's true, but there's still a big difference. And there's a difference in mentalities. You know, when I was there in the 1970s, people really didn't allow themselves to express themselves at all, or even to think differently, to think contrary to the regime. When I say people, I mean, you know, the great majority of Soviet citizens. I remember Natan Sharansky, Tolia Sharansky, as he was then known, who was the kind of liaison guy for Andrei Sakharov, saying that the only time that he really felt free was when he was in the labor camp, because in the labor camp, people did think independently, and they could talk independently. So it was a different world. It was the word totalitarian actually did apply in the Soviet Union. And for all the faults and the terrible restrictions and the ghastliness of Putin's regime, It doesn't apply to Russia today.
Right.
Yet, anyway.
Yeah, I know. It's sort of accelerating lately. It's pretty grim, and God knows where this war is going to lead us. But we'll get to that a bit later. I mean, one of the many great sort of useful things and well sort of written aspects of your book is that through Putin's biography, you really see, you get a kind of first person sense of how poor, I mean, so even if his life was that, even if his sort of childhood was in that, was in so much sort of, I don't know what we would consider pretty backwards poverty. I mean, imagine what it was like, you know, not in the outskirts of Leningrad, but in so many other parts, and how much transformation really happened in the 50s, 60s, and 70s in the Soviet Union or in Russia, Leningrad. I mean, it's is pretty amazing. Could you describe for us a bit? I don't know, the house he grew up in, initially was born into, and sort of the world that he was born into initially.
Sure. No, you make a very good point. It was still grim and gray and a kind of monotone and boring, very primitive in the time when Putin was growing up. But if you go back earlier to the 1930s and 1940s, it was a hell of a lot worse.
Right.
Because you had this, you know, Stalinist repression and the fear of a knock on the door. Life was not, you know, it was much, much more difficult in those times, not even to talk about going right back to the late 20s, early 30s, to the famines and collectivization. But to come to Putin, he was actually born at a kind of hopeful time because the war was over. There'd been, again, a famine after the war in which maybe getting on for a million Russians died. And by the early 1950s, Stalin was not yet dead, but he was going to die in a few months' time. Things were getting better. There was a lot of hope around. So it was quite a good time to have a child. And Putin grew up when Khrushchev was coming to power and the famous thaw, a little bit more liberty, a little bit more freedom, was becoming available to Russians in many different ways. But he grew up nonetheless in a really pretty grotty environment, and I say grotty deliberately. You know, a 4 or 5 story apartment building where the apartments have been divided into individual rooms, basically with plywood walls, which were very thin, and everyone could hear what was going on in the next room. There was absolutely no privacy. There was no maintenance. The roof leaked. The stairs were kind of collapsing. There were rats. There were cockroaches. You didn't have a bathroom. There was a toilet, but that was all. And it was shared among 3 families, a shared kitchen. And Putin lived with his parents in one small room. And he continued living with his parents right up to the time he was 25 in one room with them. And again, you know, that was not unusual.
Exactly.
That was what most people in that area, that part of Leningrad, where communal flats were the rule, that's the way they lived. But it was very colorless, very dull, dark. There wasn't a great deal going on. Most of the things which we in America or in Europe would take absolutely for granted as part of our lives, they weren't available.
Mm-hmm. So, again, pulling the camera back a little bit here, I guess I want to first ask, and then I want to quote a little bit from you here, but what made you decide to write about Putin? I mean, your previous books were... the main books I mentioned, Mao, Pol Pot, Mitterrand, which was, it was so different from your previous two books. It was like the evil of banality or something. I don't know. Like, it was such a, what a, uh, it was, I don't know how you were able to do that, yet it was so thorough, the Mitran book. Did you want to go back another way after that? Or
No. I mean, to me, actually, there is a complete logic to these people. Mitran was not really an exception. He was a deeply ambiguous, very complicated leader who had been through, you know, the 1930s with anti-Semitism running riot in Europe, then prisoner of war, the whole question of collaboration or not collaborating with the Germans in the war, and so on. A right-wing politician, then a left-wing politician. He's kind of got everything.
Mm-hmm. if you
feel like it. So
a weather vane.
Or
an opportunist, I guess.
As so many politicians are, a pragmatist, an opportunist. Yes, that's part of what politics is. So much of the time. Anyway, it's the complexity of Mitran, and the way in which he was, I wouldn't say the incarnation, but certainly the reflection, a mirror of almost a century of French politics and culture. And that's what's interesting about Pol Pot. He too mirrored all the contradictions of Cambodia. And Mao, of course, was the incarnation of an awful lot in China. So they were similar. And Putin, I mean, he has that quality too of, I said earlier, an authentic Russian. Mm-hmm. Putin, born when Stalin was still alive, traversing all these changes and transformations that have happened in the Soviet Union and then in Russia, he too is a mirror in some ways of both the strengths and the failures and the weaknesses, the aspirations and the aims of many Russians. So he's a kind of logical successor. But why Putin after Mitran? Because when I'd finished Mitran, I thought, who's by far the most interesting leader around? And it was with no contest, it was Vladimir Putin. And added to which, as you mentioned, I'd been in Moscow. My Russian was rusty, but it was there and it came back and I can read in Russian and so on. So, it was a country that I'd lived in and I had a lot of feeling for.
Right. So we should let people know right off the bat that your book, though really comprehensive, very long, I mean, it's 850 pages, I believe, the American edition, is without trying to, I don't know, make this the central feature of it at all, but it is combative in the sense of there is one way of there's one main way of writing about Putin today in the English-speaking world and probably most of the West. And it's very important to write that way, which is obviously to demonize him, to make him incredibly exceptional. And then there are some people who sort of, because they are against the mainstream in any way, sort of have decided to, I don't know, lionize him and see in him everything that the West fails at or something like that, rather than just sort of seeing him as he is and as Russia is. But I want to, so when I say that your book is combative, it is, it begins with probably one of the greatest heresies that you could write about or be on the side of it when you write about Putin and Russia today, which is that you do not buy into the kind of received idea today that Putin or the FSB organized the apartment bombings in 1999. And you lay out sort of both sides of the case and then you explain why, and others who also don't believe that. I mean, I mentioned to you and we've mentioned on the show that Andrei Soldatov, who is known as very much as a leading Russian critic of Putin and the FSB and the Siloviki, he didn't emphasize this. It was kind of sandwiched in one of the chapters in the middle in a couple of sentences, but he also said that he didn't believe the FSB organized it. So it's, but he didn't make that, he didn't put that in the beginning of his book. He might not have been republished anywhere if he had put that in the beginning of his book. So I just want to read a quick bit from your introduction here after you sort of lay out the case why it's extremely unlikely that Putin or the FSB organized those apartment bombings. The saga of the apartment bombings illustrates two of the main difficulties confronting anyone who seeks to penetrate the mysteries of Putin's Russia. The first was described by the historian Richard Hofstadter. This is actually an interesting quote of the American tendency to view every enemy as, quote, a perfect model of malice, a kind of amoral Superman, sinister, ubiquitous, powerful, cruel, who profits from the misery he has produced. I mean, that is a perfect distillation. So he probably wrote that, 60, 70 years ago, of how Putin is portrayed in nearly every single account. And if you violate that, it means there's something wrong with you, perhaps. You said that to suggest otherwise is to be an apologist, or at best what in Germany is called disdainfully a Putin Versteher. Versteher, a Putin understander. It's a really good word there. So, you know, tell us how you decided to approach this, and were you worried at all? Because, and I'll get into this a little bit more, but, you know, you have had some people who've kind of staked out this territory for quite some time as, you know, bleeding Putin demonizers, who've reacted, you know, not very favorably to your book, but pretty angrily to your book, I would say.
Well, that was bound to happen. And I was aware of that. But I mean, you quote Hofstadter about this American tendency to brand people as the devil incarnate. And that was written 60, 70 years ago. It just shows not much has changed.
Yeah.
Americans, and not just Americans, look on things in the same way. But no, the reason that I started with that is precisely because so many people, there are a lot of people in Russia, there are a lot of people in the West who say, oh, Putin got into power by blowing up those apartments. You know, he's an absolute bastard and completely cynical and ruthless. And I thought it was important to lay out the case that they make and then to say, well, does it stand up? Because there is, in a wider sense, it's symbolic of the whole problem of trying to understand someone like Putin. A lot of what you think is true actually turns out not to be true. A lot of what you might disbelieve is true. It's very difficult to establish the facts. And what I've tried to do in that book is establish the facts as clearly as one possibly can and let readers judge for themselves. Now, that would have been easier had there not been a war happening in Ukraine at the moment, because that obviously, and for very understandable reasons, has kind of ginned up emotions and the horror of that people feel quite rightly about what is happening in that war. And it makes it more difficult to take a kind of sober, stand back look and say, well, actually, is this true? No. Or is this not true? And so on. But just to go one last tiny bit, because I think it is important. Those who say Putin was responsible for all this, they ignore the fact that both MI6, the SIS in Britain, the guy who was head of it at the time and the guy who was head of it afterwards, and the CIA station chief in Moscow when those buildings were going up, they all say it's not true. Well, wait a minute. If the main intelligence agencies of the West say, no, there's no evidence that Putin or the FSB were responsible, and we don't believe it because it would have leaked, and there's absolutely no sense it did happen. Why do journalists who basically are, you know, dealing with usually secondhand information, why do they insist it was so? There is a basis on which one can say, no, this is all highly, highly improbable. Yet people go on believing it because it sort of suits I won't say their prejudices, but what they wish to believe.
Yes, I think people definitely wanted to believe it. I mean, I'm one of them. I'm not convinced that Putin was being. I thought it possible that elements within the sort of the Yeltsin circle, especially Berezovsky, because of his long, old, deep ties with the Chechen underworld and the Chechen, well, some of the Chechen Islamist radicals, like some of the people aligned with Basayev, might have had something to do with it, but never saw evidence of it. I had some intelligence official try to convince myself and my former writing partner, Matt Taibbi, this is back in 2000, that Berezovsky, Putin, Surkov, it was the first time I heard Surkov's name in that context, and some of Basayev's people had organized it, but never gave us even a shred of evidence, so there was nothing we could do with it. But then you have to go with Occam's razor at that point, which is, these guys were blowing up stuff. I mean, they did attack Dagestan. It's clear they were behind at least the early apartment bombings. And so if you take it from there, it's just, you know, unless you want to believe it. But I think people did want to believe it. In fact, I remember this moment when the Boston Marathon bombings happened, and it turned out to be these two young Chechen American immigrants, Tsarnaev brothers. And BuzzFeed, I remember this article in BuzzFeed, I was in a little spat with BuzzFeed at the time over this, and they had reported that there was this conspiracy theory that when the elder Tsarnaev had gone back to Dagestan and Chechnya for a year before returning, that somehow the FSB had kind of hypnotized him or something and turned him into a bomber in order to do something rather. It was never quite explained. And this was reported in BuzzFeed. And what he wrote was, although conspiracy theories, you know, we have them in the West and in Russia, but the difference is conspiracies can't happen in the West, but they do happen in Russia. And the apartment bombings are an example of a conspiracy that really did happen. It's just sort of taken on faith that it happened.
I'm not sure they don't happen in the West.
Right, well, exactly. Yeah. I know, exactly. That was kind of my point, too. Yeah. it's a really great way to open the book, because I feel like at that point, and it's not like after that you force people to completely rethink everything they've thought about Putin. After that, you actually just try to describe his life, his upbringing, his world. But it is a great way to open the book, because it forces you to either say, okay, I'm going to leave behind, you know, all this propaganda our heads are filled with and try and take a fresh look at Putin, or I'm going to be so offended by this and I so badly don't want to hear it that I'm just going to walk away. And I really exactly. respect that as a writer. I think it's great.
Throw it out the window.
Exactly.
You weren't surprised at the reviewers' treatment of the book. Have you... Were there any unexpected results there?
Not really. I mean, given, as I say, that by the time the book came out, the Ukraine war was already underway. Right. I knew that there would be people who would not wish to read a book that tried to take a sober look at it. Some of the reviews actually made me chuckle quite a bit. There were, I mean, two things. Ed Lucas, who you know.
Famous Ed Lucas, yes.
Ed Lucas, who's quite a convinced hawk. He made me laugh because he said about the apartment bombings, well, you know, older and wiser heads would raise their eyebrows at such statements. And I thought, well, wait a minute, Ed, older and wiser. I was in Moscow as head of the BBC, a Russian-speaking journalist, when you were still at school in short trousers.
Well, on top of it, the heads of MI6 and the CIA station chief also. I mean,
absolutely.
Kind of absurd.
The other thing I've run into, and this is possibly something that you will come up against, is, you know, it always takes two to tango. There are always impulses from both sides. And when you look at the reasons why Russia has become such a pariah and things have gone so badly wrong in relations between Russia and the West, yeah, the Russians, Putin, has an awful lot to do with that. But he wasn't operating in a vacuum. You know, the United States did things, canceling the ABM treaty, withdrawing from it, putting up a national missile defense, going into the Iraq war when the Russians said, look, they don't have weapons of mass destruction, you shouldn't be doing this, and so on and so forth. You know, there was a lot on both sides that really exasperated both of them. And things went downhill very gradually over a long period, and then they became irreversibly bad. Now, some of the American reviewers were very reluctant to accept that America's policies had anything to do with what had happened in Russia. So that was another thing, which was kind of a keynote of some of the more critical reviews.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, I think, as I said in my initial emails to you, I mean, the timing of your book couldn't be better and worse at the same time. I mean, better in the sense that your subject is the number one sort of, I don't know, figure in the world today, and the name on most people's minds or whatever. But at the same time, unless you're coming up with a new way to demonize him and to sort of engage in that demonizing porn that everyone does, in a sense, I mean, look, your book is clearly written for the long term. I mean, to understand him and to be read, you know, years from now. And so here you put it out, you know, in right at the time that Putin did his biggest mistake by far, I mean, bar none. And
I agree completely. And it's, you know, it's fascinating to ask oneself, well, you know, this was a guy who actually, on the whole, was quite cautious.
Yes.
And he was cautious over what he did over the last 20 years because one of the reasons was that he knew, since he was a kid, he had a propensity to take risks. So he tried to keep that really under control. And what happened to make him suddenly take this enormous risk, which was proved very quickly to be a total miscalculation, and has messed up what could have been a I won't say a positive legacy, but a much more settled legacy. And why? My answer to that is he was concerned, you know, he's 70 years old. What is my legacy going to be? What is my place in history going to be? And because that's something that has been on, you know, he's been thinking about it. There have been little signs that he's been thinking about it for years. And once you start thinking in those sorts of very subjective terms, where am I going to be in the historical documents, then that, I think that is the explanation of why he made things go so wrong, because he wasn't thinking analytically anymore. Mm. His caution was not keeping him steady. He was thinking about his place in history, and that's what screwed it all up.
That was a really interesting part, I'm sorry, of the personality that you drew out that I really didn't know about Putin, was his propensity to taking almost as a, I don't know, on principle at times, risks that could really have screwed up his life. And then his other propensity, which is to try to maintain self-control and that battle. I mean, I always saw him as more cautious and deliberate than that. And so for me, the Putin invasion, I mean, the Ukraine invasion was such a shock, but it probably wasn't as much of a shock to you after you had studied him like that.
Well, like everybody else, I didn't expect it to happen.
Right.
And you know, I can say that with a straight face because the people around Putin didn't expect it to happen.
We had to do a whole show of... okay, we were wrong.
I'm not saying it for that reason, but if you think about it, people like Sechin, who really is very close to Putin, the guys who are in, if not absolutely the core of the oldest friends, they're certainly in the 20 or so people who are closest to him. What happens to them? they get their mega yachts confiscated because they had absolutely no idea this was coming. So if we got it wrong, a lot of people who should have known a hell of a lot better got it wrong too.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's a great point.
We spent some months in Trieste recently, and the first thing you see when you're coming to Trieste is this gigantic yacht with sails. It looks like a child's drawing of a little rowboat, only then you realize, whoa, the scale is off. That is a gigantic thing.
Yeah.
And it's a Russian oligarch's yacht that has been sequestered thanks to the Ukraine war. But I was going to ask, the other factor in Putin's miscalculation in Ukraine that really stood out to me in your book is, why would you believe a clique of Russian generals who, I mean, perhaps even more than other generals who are not generally, so to speak, a truth-telling group, why would you believe their claims that all this would work?
Very good question. He did start, I mean, if you go back to 2008, just after the Georgian war, or even a few months before the war in Georgia, they did start pretty thorough reforms of the Russian army under a defense minister who's Anatoly Serdyukov. Mm-hmm. And it went quite well. I mean, they started reforming, but then Putin basically, after two or three years, called off Serdyukov and said, well, that's gone far enough, because he was concerned that the army would start being too independent and that junior officers would start. I mean, what Serdyukov wanted to do was to create a junior officer corps which would think on its feet like Western junior officers do and take initiative and innovate and so on. And Putin thought that was too dangerous politically for the regime's grip. So he stopped it. But he obviously thought that the reforms had done what they were supposed to. And his successor defense minister, Shoigu, and Gerasimov, the chief of staff, they've been in power for 12 years now. And the fact that he'd left them there, I think, you know, he believed that it was all working as it was supposed to work, which was very naive of him. And one has to ask, you know, were the counterintelligence people from the FSB who are supposed to watch over the military, military counterintelligence, were they telling him what they should have been telling him about the weaknesses of the armed forces? No, they weren't. They're all in cahoots together, and the system of oversight was not working. So he thought that it would all happen as he expected it to happen. And it must have been a pretty devastating blow when everything went horribly, horribly wrong.
Yeah.
I just wanted to go back to the biography part again a little bit, because another thing sort of looking at his life trajectory that stands out is he's an unlikely great leader, you know, somebody who's basically ruled Russia, you know, if you include the Medvedev years, which one mostly should, you know, for the last 23 years. But wait, when you look at his, there's a trajectory that is from, you know, the time he's born up until the collapse of the Soviet Union. And it's impressive. It's a working class guy from a nobody, well, sort of nobody family. I guess his father was the grandfather was a cook for Lenin, I think, or
for Lenin's sister and his widow. They had security clearances. It wasn't quite an ordinary family, but you're right. It was not in any sense, you know, a princeling family.
Right.
It was, you know, working class and doing as well as we can.
Yeah. And you know, it seemed like he had hit sort of a career ceiling where he'd done well for himself coming from this sort of lower middle class slums to, you know, getting an overseas post, not the best one, in Dresden. So he was able to kind of carve out for himself what would have been a good middle class life by Soviet standards, by later Soviet standards. But it was interesting reading your book how for lack of a better word, kind of class hierarchical, those elite areas of the Soviet state, where I know that's true, but it was interesting to see it in even in Putin's world. I mean, I know this sort of from more the Moscow world, but it was that Putin could only, it was a remarkable he got to even where he was, because who you knew and who your parents were decided so much in terms of what law school you could get into, what career track you could get into in the KGB or in another elite institution like that. But he was never going to go probably that far in the Soviet system. And then everything collapses. Is that right, you think?
I think it's absolutely right. And it is amazing how he actually did as well as he did.
Yes.
You know, he had bits of luck.
Yes.
There was, to use a modern word, diversity.
Yes. No. Yes.
Working class, you know, right. ordinary proletarian fellows were supposed to make up a certain quota of people going to university. He had sports.
Right.
He was a junior champion and so on. So that all got him into the law school. But yeah, there was a ceiling. There was an absolute glass ceiling, which had he stayed in the KGB, he would not have been able to go beyond. But I think what's interesting, you know, that we all know people who, in at least I do, in certain positions, they didn't shine, they didn't do terribly
yes.
well. And then they moved to something else, and for goodness sake, suddenly they became absolutely brilliant and indispensable. And that was a bit what happened to Putin when in Leningrad, and then it became St. Petersburg, when he went into politics, when he got attached to the mayor of St. Petersburg, Anatoly Sobchak, he found his niche. Mm-hmm. He was the guy who could push the buttons, make the trains run on time, actually make everything happen in the mayor's office. And Sobchak, the mayor himself, was quite a dilettante. He didn't like the nuts and bolts of running.
Yeah, your description of him was interesting. Because I remember back in 90, 91, the press reported on him like he was the John Kennedy of the new Russia. I mean, he was thought he was going to be the new leader because Yeltsin was kind of considered a little scary and buffoonish. But your description of him explains why he went nowhere ultimately. You know?
No, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, he's an interesting guy, but... Yeah. And those who were around him absolutely adored him. He was Koch, who was went on.
Oh, Alfred Koch,
premier.
Yeah.
Said, you know, he was the image of what we wanted a liberal politician to be, but he couldn't run a city to save his life. so Putin did that for him. And Putin made, you know, networks of friends and of colleagues who helped him into Moscow afterwards. And in Moscow, again, he shone. He was really good in the presidential administration. He went up like a helicopter, and not simply because of cronyism, but because actually he was very good at doing what he was supposed to do. And so he finished up as head of the FSB, Secretary of the Security Council, and then Prime Minister and Yeltsin's successor. He was in the right place at the right time to be indispensable.
How did could you briefly describe what his duties were as a KGB officer when he became a KGB officer, and how that prepared him to be, you know, a deputy to like a sort of chief of staff almost to Sobchak? And was he assigned that as well? What's your conclusion on that? But first, like what his area was, wasn't it spying on dissidents among other things?
It was indeed. Yeah. And this is something he's always denied and has tried to obfuscate. But no, it's absolutely clear that when he joined the KGB in 1975, he went through a period of preliminary training, but then straight into the Fifth Department, which was part of the Leningrad Directorate that was kind of subordinate to the Fifth Directorate in nationally, which was the one that looked out for dissidents and looked after people in the churches, looked after, you know, artists and creative people who were viewed as dissenters. And he did that for 3 or 4 years, until, again, he went for a second time in Moscow, a second training period, and was moved to the first department, which was concerned with foreigners. And mm-hmm. the first department, we don't really know what he did there, because there weren't very many foreigners in Leningrad at that time.
Right.
There were a few businessmen. One of our colleagues, there was a UPI correspondent, very briefly, who was given a terrible time by the KGB. So he was there. Then eventually he got his big break. He went to the Andropov Institute in Moscow. This is 1984, for a year's training, and hoping to go somewhere in the West, like Berlin or Vienna. And he didn't do that well. He didn't. He was sent back to Leningrad and eventually seconded to Dresden, which was a comfortable, almost a sinecure, where he put on a lot of weight, he drank a lot of beer, and he didn't do very much.
Right. I know it's incredible to think that he had that life at that age, the guy who later became who he is.
But, well, exactly. Yeah. No, yeah. But it's horses for courses. He had to find his right place. And way he found his right place, I have absolutely no doubt. The documentary evidence is not there, I must be honest. But there's oral evidence and there's circumstantial evidence that he was, before he left East Germany to go back to Russia, the Soviet Union, he had a meeting with a general from the Fifth Department who'd flown out specially to Berlin to see him, to East Berlin, to say, we need somebody, and we've decided you're the best bet. We need someone to attach themselves to Sobchak, because our big worry in the KGB now is not so much dissidents, it's all these liberal, pseudo-democratic politicians like Sobchak and others who are rising through the political hierarchy. And we need to keep tabs on them. So you go back and you be his minder. And that's how he got to Sobchak, and that's how eventually he developed his political career in Leningrad.
They must have understood at least that he had a talent for, that he wasn't a slacker, that he was organized and he could get things done, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. He was organized, he could get things done. And he was very good at, how shall I put this, particularly with older people, winning their confidence. He talked about himself as being a public relations specialist, and that wasn't complete rubbish. He was good at winning people's confidence, and he certainly did that with Sobchak, and he did it with the actually quite senior man who was about to retire, Lazar Matveyevich, who was the head of the KGB bureau in Dresden. And I think Matveyevich was instrumental in the choice of Putin to be attached to Sobchak in Leningrad, and hence to be put into a political orbit where he would in the end prosper.
He doesn't seem to have been at any time a communist. He doesn't seem to have that any sort of fondness for communism. I mean, he clearly becomes anti-communist, and it gets more and more sort of out in the open during his presidency. But even back in those days, but I don't know, maybe there weren't a whole lot of true believing communists when he grew up.
Well, I think by the time he got to Dresden, no, there were not many people who believed. If you look back, it was around the early 60s, the end of the Khrushchev period, that people really started to lose faith. It was very hard to continue believing in the system, and became much harder under Brezhnev with all his kind of claptrap about Marxist-Leninist orthodoxy. So by the time that Putin was about 10, the context had was changing. And as far as one can tell, he never, he became a member of the Komsomol, of the Communist Party Youth League.
Right.
But very much kind of on sufferance. It wasn't something which enthused him. He did it because he had to. You couldn't get into university otherwise. But there's absolutely, it's very difficult to find even a tiny grain of genuine enthusiasm or belief in the communist system at any point, even in Putin's youth.
Yeah. Oh, very much in his youth. I was thinking of the hilarious part of your chapter about his childhood and adolescence, where he doesn't make it into the pioneers, and he doesn't want to make it into the pioneers in the first place. And it's like, you know, I don't want to belong to your Weeblos scouting thing. I'm like, the hell with it. And then he finally grudgingly accepts a kind of backdoor membership in the pioneers.
Well, he accepted and decided that it was something he had to do, because that was the point we were talking earlier about, are you going to begin, you know, go to a life of crime and go up that ladder, or are you going to try and do something better for yourself? Well, that was the moment when he joined the pioneers, and then he joined the Komsomol and so on. That was all part of his decision that he was going to make something better for himself in his own life.
I noticed that for the, maybe this is mostly for the Petersburg period, you had, from your notes, that you had interviewed Charlie Ryan, who was a banker. I knew Charlie a little bit back in the day, and I'm trying to remember, I think he was with Dresner later. I'm not sure in the 90s, but he seemed to have, I think he worked in Petersburg in the 90s. Is that right? Is
he,
that
where he wasn't with Dresner, no. He was with Deutsche Bank.
Deutsche
and
Bank,
he was. He was indeed. He was about 24, and he went out with EBRD, European Bank of Reconstruction and Development.
Right. And so, what sort of impressions did he give you of Putin working in the mayor's office at that time?
Oh, Charlie was very interesting because he had an insider's view. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he said, which always struck me, because there's been a lot of discussion, you know, how corrupt was Putin? How corrupt is Putin? How was he then? And Charlie said, you know, there were basically three kinds of politician and bureaucrats. There was the A's, who would never accept anything. And were absolutely clean and straight. And there were very, very, very few of them.
I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah, rare species, rare birds. And the bees, who, they put something away for their old age, but they basically did their jobs, and they didn't ask or didn't have their hand out all the time. Mm-hmm. And the Cs, who wouldn't pick up a pen without being paid for it. Mm-hmm. And he said, Putin was a solid B. Mm-hmm. In other words, he would accept. There's a difference, you know, between accepting a gratuity, an expression of thanks for something you've already done, and being bribed or being paid to do something. Well, Putin was in the former category. He would accept from people he trusted expressions of thanks for what he'd done. But he would not demand money in order to do something.
Right. Yeah, you. That was a really great description in your book of the difference between those two different types of corruption. And corruption was and is the system that moves things in Russia. I mean, it's different from Western culture in that. And the corruption is very different.
I'm not keen on the word, kleptomaniac and kleptocracy, because for me, that's Mobutu Sese Seko in Zaire or the president of Equatorial Guinea. It's not the way Russia works. Russia is, I'm preaching to the converted on this, sure, but it's much more of a patrimonial society. And Putin... part of his grasp on power is allowing those around him to make money by because they have privileged access to state contracts. It's not a matter of actually demanding huge bribes to do something or get something done. It's profiting from your proximity to power. And Russia really has always been like that. So it's just a new iteration of a very old system, which goes back many centuries.
So Petersburg, when he was there, I have to say, it became sort of known as a crime. I mean, compared even to Moscow, as a much more criminalized, and sort of dangerous place And the 90s in Moscow were also quite dangerous and criminalized, but it was a little bit more, it lasted a little bit longer in Petersburg beyond when he left in 96. And it was just a bit more raw, the crime wars and stuff. You know, I think this was one of the things that bothered Edward Lucas and some others, that you didn't put him at the center of the notorious Tambovsky Grupirovka, the Tambov gang, and the Spog scandal and some of these other things. But the way you describe Putin, which sounds very sounds very plausible and a lot more plausible, is that Putin came into this situation. It's not like Putin created this violent, you know, milieu of St. Petersburg in the 90s, but as sort of the deputy mayor or kind of like a chief of staff, he had to work in the hard reality of the situation. I mean, that seems to be a feature of his throughout, I'd say up until he decided to invade Ukraine. He always kind of looked at things coldly, like, this is the hard reality. This is what we have to do to get things done. And then you can ascribe to him either, you know, absolute nefarious, oh, that means Putin created this reality or Putin is the center of it. Or you say, well, this is the world that he dealt with and that he moved within and, you know, was able to look at it coldly and function well within it. Does that sound right?
He's very, very, very cynical, very pragmatic. He used to say, there's no point spitting into the wind. This is the situation we have. You have to deal with it. And you're absolutely right when you talk about St. Petersburg being much more crime-ridden, much more dangerous than Moscow at that time. Gleb Pavlovsky, who was Yeltsin's and then Putin's spin doctor, and he's now dead, but he fell out with Putin, said, you know, St. Petersburg was a place where crime and politics and business all had one interface. And it's absolutely true. The mayor, the mayor's office could not function without dealing with the criminal gangs. And that was true not just when Putin was there, it continued under Sobchak's successor. So it was a very peculiar situation. And Putin was deeply involved with it, but he was not at the center of it. I think that is a complete misreading. It was the context in which he had to operate. And it's been very much the same, as you say, ever since. He's operated in the context in which he's found himself and which he's, especially more recently, has helped create. But it's not a system that he conjured out of nowhere. It's what he found and what he had to deal with.
And that doesn't absolve him either, because as an actor within that, of course, that means he's also, you know, guilty of whatever crimes go on within that. But to ascribe to him sort of the central maker of this corrupt...
I think that's a very important point. Yeah. He has allowed, while he's been president, a climate of impunity. So that when people like Anna Politkovskaya, the journalist, was executed by Chechen gunmen, when Nemtsov was killed, former deputy prime minister just outside the Kremlin, when many other murders have taken place, it's not that they were ordered by Putin, but he did not make any effort to bring those responsible to justice. And in that sense, he's deeply responsible for all these abominations that have taken place under his regime. And one has to emphasize that, because he could have taken action, and he hasn't. And that has created this climate of impunity where those with power feel they can do absolutely anything. They can commit murder, order murders, and get away with it.
It should be added that in the Yeltsin era, I mean, Yeltsin's... many famous people were assassinated as well. And again, this isn't to absolve Putin, but it is to put things into context. I mean, Dmitry Holodov from the Moskovsky Komsomolets was famously killed by a by a briefcase bomb that was almost certainly planted by Yeltsin's defense minister, corrupt defense minister Pavel Grachov, otherwise known as Pavel Mercedes.
Pasha Mercedes, absolutely.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about.
I do. No, you're absolutely right. And people, this is another mistake that people tend to make. They say, you know, oh, the system was wonderful under Yeltsin, and then Putin came. Yeah. No, it was not wonderful under Yeltsin. In fact, most of the things, you know, the systemic changes which have taken Russia away from a democratic future started under Yeltsin.
Right.
The 1993, to start with, you know,
yes.
Yeltsin basically abolished parliament. He shelled the White House where the MPs were. That was not a very democratic thing to do, but because... He was the guy that we were relying on to look after Russia. We didn't say anything. We didn't complain.
And well, then we announced billions in more aid, like literally days after he bombed the White House.
Absolutely. Yeah. And yeah. 1996, we sent people and we sent money secretly to help Yeltsin's re-election campaign. And it was a really dirty re-election campaign.
Yes.
The moment, you know, I think it was Vladimir Posner who said that, you know, that was the moment we lost our innocence with that campaign. So an awful lot that we now associate with Putin's Russia started under Yeltsin. And I think this is a kind of warning thing. Mm-hmm. It's no good saying if Putin were not there, everything would just be hunky-dory. We'd all be, you know, back to a very harmonious relationship and Russia would suddenly become democratic. No way. That's not going to happen. Putin is not, in that sense, a total aberration.
Right.
It's going to be a very long process, I feel, for Russia to develop a different kind of system.
Yeah. So getting into Putin's presidency, I mean, this would be sort of like the third act in your book in a sense. And it's, having been around for it and in Russia part of that time, I have to say rereading your narrative account of, I mean, so much of it is Putin sort of saying out loud and kind of to himself, but really saying out loud, look, I don't have any illusions about the West. I know that they see things their way. We have our own interests, but we can always find a way of working together. But please listen to me on this one or two or three things. And the West, really America, that is, sort of saying, you know, yeah, but, you know, what are you going to do? And we're going to do A, B, and C, whether you like it or not. And it really unfolds it's really quite a tragedy. There's no other way to put it, which just turns horrible, you know, at the very, very end, which is 2022. But up till then, it's just like this long, slow unfolding tragedy that I remember feeling this even as it was happening in the early 2000s. Like, you don't have to love Putin, but it's pretty clear that if you're sort of running roughshod over whatever he's declaring would be, and you know, is a problem, and you're just ignoring it over and over, you know, ripping up the ABM treaty was a big one. Putting Green Berets into Georgia was humiliating. You know, expanding NATO, going into the Baltics, like on and on and on. I mean, it's kind of surprising going back and reading again, and it's very important. I feel like this is one of the most important parts of your book, that Putin has been saying and warning about the same thing over and over for 20 years, and no one listened. And so I guess you could decide, well, he's a monster and we never had to listen. Or you can think, well, was there a way that things could have turned out a little bit differently? What do you think about that?
I think future historians will be more clear-sighted than the present generation is about shared responsibility. In other words, the West, the United States in particular, George W. Bush, people like Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, the neocons, they really do have a lot to answer for. But it wasn't, it's not just the neocons. If you think back, Clinton, it was Bill Clinton, the Democrat, who said about the end of, you know, Yeltsin in the 1990s when NATO expansion began, well, you know, they got to eat their spinach.
Right.
George H.W. Bush, even earlier, said, you know, we won, they lost.
Yes.
It was this tremendous sense of triumphalism, of hubris, that they just had to, the Russians had to accept that they were on their knees, they couldn't do anything, and America could do whatever it wished. That, I mean, you know, it's understandable in the sense that America was kind of riding on the crest of the wave. But in the long term, it was not a sensible policy to follow.
No, and I think there was another aspect to that. Like, I remember in Raging Bull, there's a scene where Jake LaMotta is supposed to take a dive, and he just throws one perfunctory punch, and the guy gets knocked out, and he's going, oh, come on, come on, come on. I mean, Russia was supposed to, or the Soviet Union, was supposed to be the enemy that many sectors in the United States and the wider West love to hate, because it had become a very cautious power. It was involved mm-hmm. in conventional warfare. It was somewhat slow at making political, geopolitical moves. There was a lot of sorrow when it collapsed, and not because anybody was sorry for the Soviet Union itself, but because this perfect, you know, opponent for the Harlem Globetrotters had suddenly collapsed. And I think there's been a lot of mourning over that. And there's a kind of ill-concealed glee in many quarters that it's back.
Yeah. It's one of the things that bothers me is the way in which we are now, in a way, setting Russia up as a straw man. And what I mean by that is, you know, we're talking about NATO. NATO now has a new kind of willpower to defend its own territory if Russia attacks. We're getting much more from the military-industrial complex. Many more arms are being made. We're forward positioning our troops and so on. On the assumption that we really do need to defend ourselves, and I'm talking about the NATO, you know, the NATO area in Europe, against a possible Russian attack. And yet, Putin already has a bloody nose from Ukraine, and he's desperately trying to, you know, get out of the mess he's created there. The likelihood of Russia attacking NATO is pretty well vanishingly small. And the danger of setting up what I'd call a straw man is that you raise military tensions, the risk of miscalculation, misjudgments further down the road occur, and it makes more likely that we will finish up with an escalation, which everyone says they don't want, into a much wider war. We've seen this happen before. You know, I mean, we set up Saddam Hussein as a straw man by saying he had weapons of mass destruction, which he didn't. Right. And the result was complete chaos in the Middle East.
Yes.
So that does worry me. I mean, I understand that the Poles and the Balts are emphasizing their concerns about, you know, a possible Russian aggression. If I were Polish or Estonian, I would do that too. But it's a bit the tail wagging the dog. Europe and the United States are being pushed and convinced mm-hmm. that this is a plausible and imminent threat, whereas it's a very, very, very unlikely thing to happen.
Yeah, even in strictly military terms, it's like, look, they couldn't take Kiev. That's kind of significant.
Let alone Bakhmut.
If they can't take Kiev, when are they going to be in Warsaw? Or even in Tallinn? I think it's right that there be contingency planning, but it should be proportional. You know, if there's a 0.1% chance it should happen, plan on that basis, not plan as though it's an imminent threat.
Based on your understanding, you spent 8 years sort of, you know, researching and in the mind and life of Putin. what do you think, I guess kind of two questions. How do you think this war could possibly end? I mean, is there a way that it ends? I mean, the West has said it should not end with anything less than a complete obvious defeat for Putin personally, that it must be absolutely clear and obvious that he's defeated and he doesn't have the capacity to do anything like this again. So, do you see that happening? Do you see a possibility for the end of this war? And also, do you see any possibility for that Putin might turn to nukes, the way some people have talked about?
Well, you say the West is demanding that.
Right. Maybe U.S.
The Ukrainians certainly.
Okay.
For very understandable reasons.
Yes,
and again,
yes.
You know, they want the Russians completely out.
Right.
And Lloyd Austin, to start with, did, if you remember, he said,
yes.
And so did some of the people in the State Department. Yeah,
right.
we want a defeat so they can never do it again. I haven't
right.
heard so much of that more recently.
That's true.
And people like Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff,
yes.
he's taken a rather more cautious line about what the possible end game is. The first thing to say is, wars are completely unpredictable.
Yes.
Anyone who pretends to know how this is going to end, I mean, frankly, is talking through their hat. The most plausible end game, I think, is for Russia to hold enough of the Donbass, to hold Crimea and the land bridge between them, because Putin can then, for his domestic audience, say, well, we've done what we needed to do. And America could say, well, they wanted to take over the whole of Ukraine. We've defended the Ukrainians. We've prevented them destroying Ukrainian sovereignty. So each side would be able to spin that in a way which made them look good. Ukrainians would hate it.
Yes.
They would loathe it.
Yes.
and that's another completely unpredictable factor.
Exactly.
But I can only keep saying, you know, that would be a plausible outcome. But whether that is the outcome that is going to happen, absolutely no one can say. You asked about nukes. Fundamentally, I think the use of nuclear weapons, it's a very useful threat for Putin. If he were ever to get to the stage of wanting to actually do it, it would be much less useful. Once it's done, it's kind of lost its the pressure on the West. So I don't think, again, it's unpredictable. You can't rule it out totally, but I think he will try and keep it as a threat rather than actually doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another thing that you point out is, especially early on, he was talking all the time about how Russia's place is in Europe. And although that it will sort of go on a not exactly the same course, that it's generally going on a European and liberal course. And that you don't hear that from Putin or the immediate people around him at all anymore.
No.
You don't.
But you wouldn't expect to, because this is not the moment. And it may not be the moment for some time. Mm. This is a whole area which, frankly, no one is really thinking about or talking about at the moment. And again, for understandable reasons, there's a war going on. They want to, you know, both sides want to win the war and so on. But there is a bigger problem. What is the relationship between Russia after the war and Europe and the West going to be? Because Europe is not going to move. Russia is not going to move. They're going to be side by side, and Ukraine is going to be sandwiched in the middle. There is, you know, there's an after the end game, which is maybe a long way down the road, but we're not talking about. And I think in that after the end game, Russia, the foundations of Russian culture have a lot more to do with Europe than they have to do with Asia. And that's going to be a problem, because the Russian-Chinese alliance, unstated, maybe tacit alliance, makes a lot of sense for them both at the moment. But is Russia's place really with China indefinitely? I don't think it is.
I mean, they've been both sort of pushed into each other's arms. It could be argued, I think so, you know.
Yeah, there's a shared interest because they both regard the United States as their enemy, as their adversary. The Chinese have been saying America is, an adversary ever since the early 1990s after Tiananmen. It's not a recent thing. And they find Russia, with its huge resources, is now in the same position. So there's this kind of commonality. And I think that will last a long time. But in the very long term, is Russia's place with China? Are they going to send their kids to university in Shanghai, in Beijing, buy property
there? I doubt it.
It doesn't quite fit, does it?
Yeah. Not if you've known Russia and lived there and stuff. It would require a real, revolutionary cultural change that would be pretty intense.
I don't think it's going to happen.
I don't see that either.
We have to get over this, you know. So you're looking at the kind of the median term, probably in terms of the next few decades, and then you're looking at the much longer term of where Russia's place in the world will be.
So what surprised you most about Putin's in those 8 years you wrote the book? Was there something in there that really sort of surprised you, or did you learn it all sort of so much, you know, piece by piece, that it all kind of fit together like a jigsaw and it made sense the whole time?
Well, it's kind of like a mandala, or, with grains of sand making the picture. But just one tiny thing, which I have always been intrigued by, the way in which he tells lies. And once the lie has served its purpose, he doesn't mind anymore, whether it's proved to be, you know, fake and false or whatever. You think of the little green men who went into Crimea, and he said, no, come on. They could have bought their uniforms in any kind of used army surplus store. And then 3 months later, he said, well, of course they were our troops. And if you follow, I mean, ever since he's been quite young, that has been a characteristic he doesn't care. Once the lie has been used, okay, fine. All right, well, it wasn't true, was it? How stupid of you to believe it.
It seems related to something he says, and you quote this in your book, where he mentions, I don't hold grudges. You know, it's just not part of the deal. Like, it's almost as if he doesn't hold grudges even against his own conscience. Like, oh, yeah, you got to tell some lies.
Well, there you go.
I mean, that's one of the tragedies, or I guess one of the character transformations that you do see in Putin, though, that in the 90s and then his first two terms, which were very successful by Russian standards and a lot of world leader standards. I mean, the first two terms from 2000 to 2008.
Yeah.
He's a lot more understated. He isn't like brashly bossing people around, like that famous meeting in February of last year with his kind of National Security Council chiefs.
No, and he has this dry sense of humor.
Yes.
Sometimes really kind of fun.
And he's gotten nastier, hasn't he?
Yeah.
More imperious and nastier.
Yes, but I think a lot of that is play acting.
Right.
I really do think, meeting of the Security Council, which was televised just before the invasion, which you mentioned, where he's one side of a room and they're all kind of lined up like
with their heads
terrified
down.
School children on the other side. No, that I think was deliberate theatricality. You know, I'm a megalomaniac. You don't know what I'm going to do. You watch it in the West. I'm not controllable.
Right.
It's the old Nixon
theory about, you know, playing the crazy guy.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And the giveaway was you saw him, at one end of a long table, which was about 5 or 6 meters long, and cowering at the other end is his defense minister and the chief of staff. And then 2 or 3 days later, you saw him and his defense minister sitting side by side chatting. Once again, it doesn't matter. So long as it serves its purpose, it doesn't matter if we see through it eventually.
Right.
Or as his coach noted, like, once the fight's over, We're all friends again.
Right.
Well, that would be a very nice point on which to close. If only we could be all friends again. Hard to see.
Yes, that's great. We usually say, and on that happy note, but I think on that happy note, I think we could finish off this great discussion with you. We've kept you for a long time, and I really appreciate it, Philip, for talking to us. Highly recommend everyone get his book, Putin. It really stands out in a big way. I have to admit, I don't really read the other. I've avoided almost all the other sort of Putin biographies unless I've had to do a book review because they're all roughly the same. And this one really gets into Russia and Putin, and it's gives you a much deeper and more nuanced understanding. So anyway, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
We look forward to everything you put out. And
thank you, Mark. Thank you very, very much, both of you. Thanks.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Philip. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, that was our interview with Philip Short, author of the Putin book. We'll put links in the episode here so that I recommend everybody who's interested in this or just interested in good biographies to get his Putin biography. And you know, it's a bit jarring to read a Putin biography in the middle of all of this, but it puts you kind of ahead of the curve, unless you want the usual sort of, you know, the sort of demonization porn. And it's not that Putin comes off good. It's not that he comes off as like, oh, he's actually a great guy. It's the opposite of what there's, it's just, it comes off more realistic and three-dimensional and a lot more interesting.
Yeah, that's why we mentioned several times Lomonov's account of his own adolescence, because he's of the same generation as Putin. And I, for one, was really surprised at how many parallels there are.
I made some notes in the book on that. I translated one of, just for myself, a Lomonov short story some years ago about when he was maybe more like 13 or so in Kharkiv, 13 or 14, and it's a story about this local gangster, Yura Bembel, a Jewish Russian gangster, and all the kids in the Saltovka district in Kharkov were just, you know, he was like a rock star to them because he'd been in jail, he'd been, you know, he came back, he knew all the Vorzakon language, and it was just so cool to be around him, and then these kids wanted to emulate Yura Bembel. And he was so tragic, and he winds up at the end of it, he winds up getting arrested again for some other crime and executed, because this was when it was a transition to, I don't know, Brezhnev's people sort of imposing a kind of a new order over Ukraine. I think this is before Brezhnev takes over Russia itself, but I think it was more like imposing his order on Ukraine. And so they wind up executing him. And anyway, you know, it was similar in the sense that Lomonov describes one of his best friends, Kat, actually, I think it's Kat who's also in Podrosok Savienko. Yeah, how he was just so enamored of Yurik Bimble and just decides very consciously to become a gangster. Yeah. And Lomonov kind of goes the other way. And it's very similar.
Yeah. I remember the line from all those gangster songs they sing, "The people demanded execution." Yes.
Anyways, thank you again to everybody. Thank you to Philip Short for taking all the time talking to us, and Brendan and everyone. Talk to you again soon.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Bye.